to our big surprise, we saw a curve that looked exactly the opposite, where we had a flat line at lower inclusion rates and then a drop in growth performance and a drop in gain to feed when we exceeded a certain level of calcium in the diets. So that looked completely different.
We want to thank the innovative companies and products whose support and trust make this podcast possible.
DietForge.ai, AI-powered feed formulation with non-linear ingredient modeling and real-time collaboration. Finally, modern software for modern nutritionists. Summer challenges finish your pig performance. Digestrum Finish can help. Learn more at dsm-firmenich.com/finish. Adiseo provides programs and services to help producers achieve their targets in high-quality, safe, and sustainable way. SUNY, we provide value-added biotech solutions. Your pork checkoff is all in on improving U.S. swine health. Learn more at porkcheckoff.org/strategy.
Well, good afternoon, everyone, and welcome to another episode of the SwineIt Podcast. I'm your host, Trey Kellner, and I'm excited today because I'm joined by a dear colleague, Dr. Hans Stein, professor at the University of Illinois, who leads the Monogastric Nutrition Laboratory. Hans, how are you today?
I'm doing very well, Trey. Thank you for having me.
Oh, my pleasure. So we could talk about a lot of things, right? But they're limiting us to about 25 minutes here. So we're going to try to focus on requirements for calcium and phosphorus in developing gilts and gestating sows here. But prior to that, a little bit of an introduction on Hans. Hans grew up on a small family farm in Denmark, started his education there, then got his PhD at the University of Illinois, went to South Dakota State, and has been at Illinois for a few years now. I won't try to date you or anything like that, Hans, but a few years, and is a respected member of our nutrition committee a field in industry, and really excited to pick his brain. So before we jump into a deep dive on calcium and phosphorus requirements, let's just kind of discuss your current research program. What are you currently working on, Hans? Maybe highlight a couple graduate students or what they're working on and what has you excited currently.
Well, I mean, we are excited about a lot of things, the two main areas we work on right now is calcium and phosphorus, and that also has gotten us a little bit into to vitamin D work and some other things there. And of course, phytase comes into that as well. So that's one area we have worked on for the last more than 15 years now. We're quite excited about that. And then the other major area in our program is net energy we work on also. And we are very excited about that. We think we have some very, very exciting data. And we have been convinced that there's a lot of work that needs to be done in that area as well. So those are the two major areas. Then a smaller area where I usually have one or two graduate students working is on amino acids nutrition for humans, where we also use a pig as a model for humans, but try to define the protein quality of human foods. And that's a very exciting area also. So those are the main things we are working on, yes.
Yes, well, we'll have to do subsequent episodes on the area 2 and 3 because we could spend hours on that as well.
Yeah, that's true.
Looking to improve the performance of your finisher pigs this summer? Digestrome Finish offers a phytogenic solution that boosts feed digestibility, enhances growth performance, and reduces mortality and morbidity. Trials show that Digestrome Finish can help you achieve a faster, heavier finish and better profitability. Learn more at dsm-firmenich.com/finish.
Let's jump into calcium and phosphorus. So just start big picture, right? Some of our listeners are going to know exactly what a requirement is. Some have only heard about it. So Dr. Stein, could you just define what is a requirement when we talk about calcium and phosphorus requirement? And why are these requirements important?
In general, when we define requirements for any nutrient, not only calcium and phosphorus, but for any nutrient, that would basically, in a few words, you can describe as saying we need to feed enough of that nutrient in a digestible form that will cover all requirements by that animal in whatever physiological state the animal is in. So when we talk about sows, they can either be gestating or they can be lactating. So, and they have that influences the requirement, because obviously a lactating animal will deposit nutrients in the milk so the baby pigs can get their nutrients. And so the requirement for that sow is influenced by what status she's in. And if she's lactating, she has a specific requirement for milk production in addition to her own requirement. But overall, you can say if we can keep an animal in nutrient balance, then we have met the requirement. So that's what we are trying to do.
Yeah. So let's describe, before you get into your current findings and new information for our audience, our field's been working on this for a while, right? So let's just start. Hey, how have we started, you know, back in the, you know, 30s, 40s, 50s, 60s, right, with establishing these requirements? And what have we kind of learned from those early attempts to today?
Well, I think one big difference from earlier studies and until today is that today we work with digestible calcium and digestible phosphorus, not the total amounts. And that is because we have learned that there's quite a bit of difference among the different feed ingredients in how well the animals can digest them. As an example, if you take phosphorus in corn, it may be digested by 20-25%, whereas if you use monocalcium phosphate, it may be 80%. So there are some big differences. So obviously, if you only work with total amount of those nutrients, then you will not capture those differences among our sources. So that's why we have moved to digestible phosphorus, and we are pushing to also move to digestible calcium, because that is equally important, or maybe even more important than using digestible phosphorus. But I think that those are the major changes we have from earlier requirement estimates. And then I think today also we understand that in addition to what the animal deposit in the body or in the milk for a lactating sow, there's also what we call an endogenous loss of the nutrients, which are nutrients that were absorbed by the animal, but then they were deposited into the intestinal tract again in the form of, could be enzymes or cells that are sloughed off or other things. And those endogenous losses have to kind of be subtracted from the requirements, because they cannot be used to deposit into the body or be used to deposit in the fetus or in the milk for a lactating sow. So I think that's something we also have learned, which were maybe not understood 30, 40, 50 years ago.
Yeah, thanks for that introduction. So what have your team and you recently learned that you would like to share with our audience?
Well, I mean, we have learned a lot of things, but we also have a lot of things we still need to do when it comes to sows. But if we take a step back, we started working on calcium more than 15 years ago. And we kind of got into that because around 2010, 2011, I served on the NRC committee that prepared our current NRC 2012 edition. And one of the things we worked on there was to set requirements for calcium and phosphorus. And when it came to phosphorus, we felt, in particular in growing pigs, we had pretty solid evidence. We were in pretty good shape in terms of defining those requirements. And we did that. Sows, a little bit less certain, but there were quite a bit of data for sows also. But when it came to calcium, there was just nothing. And there was had really been no calcium work done for many, many years. And I think one reason maybe was that nutritionists thought, well, limestone is cheap, so who cares? And let's just make sure there's a little bit extra in there so that the animals don't get into a deficiency. And so so I learned from that work that there is a need for at least to confirm those requirement estimates we have, because to be honest, those requirement estimates we have in the NRC were not based on a lot of solid evidence. We had to make a lot of assumptions to come to those to those estimates. So that kind of taught me, well, maybe there is a need to at least confirm that they are correct, those estimates. And if you read carefully that NRC version, you will also see that the committee said we really should have calcium requirements based on digestible calcium, but we don't have the data. Nobody has measured digestibility of calcium like we had for phosphorus. So therefore, it was not possible, but in the future, we should do that. So we started out based on that to determine digestibility in a number of different feed ingredients that provide calcium into our diets. And once we felt we had enough of those and we measured that without phytase and with phytase, and then when we felt we had enough, then we started doing some small requirement experiments with weanling and growing pigs. And that's kind of where we really saw the first big surprise, because we had expected, you know, a traditional titration study. You go from being deficient in the nutrient and up to having an excess. And you expect to see an increase in performance until a certain point. And if you're really lucky, you get a nice break point, and then it flattens out after that, right? And that's what we had expected. And to our big surprise, we saw a curve that looked exactly the opposite, where we had a flat line at lower inclusion rates and then a drop in growth performance and a drop in gain to feed when we exceeded a certain level of calcium in the diets. So that looked completely different. And it was obviously surprising and also exciting at the same time, because here was something that nobody had really looked at before. And then I've had four PhD dissertations and four master's students' theses finished just on calcium and just on calcium work in growing pigs. And we have kind of over time defined those requirements. We understand a little bit why it is we get that curve that goes down with excess calcium in the diets. And we have requirement estimates for pigs from weaning until market. And we are pretty confident in those requirement estimates for digestible calcium and digestible phosphorus. We have validated those in performance trials, so we feel very good about those. But then, of course, then you have to go into sows and see, so what do we do there? And the first experiment we did with sows was simply to say, okay, are sows digesting calcium and phosphorus to the same degree as a growing pig does? Can we use the same digestibility values that we have for growing pigs? And we realized very quickly, no, we cannot. Sows have a much, much lower digestibility of both calcium and phosphorus than what growing pigs have. So that in itself means that we have to develop digestibility values for calcium and phosphorus in all the ingredients we're using for our diets. And so that's kind of where we are today, where we are trying to develop those digestibility values.
Yeah, that's awesome. So as you define those, right, let's kind of separate those. So what have we learned? What's different between a developing gilt that's still growing in a gestating sow in terms of phosphorus and calcium requirements?
Yeah, the developing gilt is more similar to a normal terminal pig, but the requirements are greater if we assume that we want to maximize bone ash or bone strength in those animals. So we increase the phosphorus requirement by about 20% from NRC terminal animals, and then we use a calcium to phosphorus relationship to estimate the calcium requirements, and that relationship is different from the relationship that we need to maximize gain. So we kind of have two different relationships. One that will maximize the gain, which gain and gain to feed, which we use for the terminal animals. And then we have a different ratio that we use for the developing gills to get their to meet their requirements. But we feel reasonably well about the developing gills. Also, we think we understand at least how to maximize bone ash for those gills.
A worldwide leader in animal nutrition, Adiseo's portfolio of products includes nephironine, the full range of vitamins, enzymes, organic selenium, probiotics, mycotoxin management strategies, and palatability products. With such a diverse offering, Adiseo supports its customers with a broad range of expertise, tools, and services to help them maintain a competitive advantage. Adiseo, fueling predictable profits. To learn more, visit Adiseo at www.adiseo.com.
Yeah. What do you think we still have to learn or uncover about making our requirements even more precise and accurate from where they are today?
Well, in particular, when we talk about sows, they are a lot more challenging than growing pigs because it looks like the gestating sow has a very low digestibility early on in gestation, and then later it gets the digestibility increases. So if we take the last four weeks before farrowing, she has a greater digestibility than before that time. So that means we probably need to work with two different digestibility values for both calcium and phosphorus in gestation. And then in lactation, they have a little bit greater digestibility than in late gestation also. So we need another digestibility value for the lactating sow. So we're really talking about three different digestibility values that we need to generate for those animals to be able to formulate diets based on digestible calcium and digestible phosphorus. And then to make it even more complicated, we also have a different response in sows to microbial phytase than we have in growing pigs. In growing pigs, we think we understand microbial phytase reasonably well, and we understand how much calcium is released by phytase and how much phosphorus is released. But in sows, it seems to be very different, and we don't get the same release of calcium and phosphorus in sows. However, as I said at the beginning, I do have a graduate student right now who is working on vitamin D. And in sows, and what we have learned there is if we use a specific vitamin D metabolite called 25-hydroxy-D3, then we can actually increase digestibility of calcium and phosphorus a little bit also, in addition to what we have from the phytase. So we seem to have some different responses in sows than we do in growing finishing pigs. But there's a lot of moving parts when it comes to sows.
Yes, and you can create moving parts not only with nutrients, as you talk about vitamin D, but maybe ingredients that are used within swine diets as well. Any thoughts on that?
Yeah, I mean, the different ingredients, they will influence how we add limestone and dical and monocal, of course, to the diets. Of course, limestone is a really important ingredient, and I think we overlook that too much because the detrimental effects of overfeeding calcium in growing finishing pigs and sows is huge. It's huge. And so we need to understand how much calcium we have in the diet. And in a diet with phytase, we typically have 2/3 of all the calcium comes from limestone. So if you don't understand that ingredient, then you kind of will have a difficult time formulating an accurate diet. And so the limestone is really, really important for us. And we have done quite a bit of research on that. And we are actually we're doing another experiment right now with 18 different sources of limestone. So we have worked a lot on limestone to really understand that and find out if we can characterize limestone sources. So that is one important ingredient that we are very concerned about. And another thing I should mention also, that it's extremely important that when we formulate diets, in particular for growing finishing pigs, that we lower calcium enough when we have phytase in the diets, because there's a greater release of calcium than there is of phosphorus when we do that. And if we don't lower calcium enough, then we will not get we will not maximize gain of the pigs.
Oh, for sure. And, you know, to emphasize that practical point, I'd also encourage, anyone that's formulating diets or overseeing diets to think about calcium in terms of coming in other ingredients, whether that be an additive or medication, et cetera, right? So calcium can come in different ingredients in different ways. Yeah. So make sure you get your diets analyzed. Make sure that you know what the calcium content of your diets is relative to what you have in your matrix values. In your formulation and what you're trying to hit as well. So
absolutely, that's very important. And it's challenging because many of our ingredients, including soybean meal, DDGS, bakery meal, etc., they are very variable in calcium because there's sometimes added limestone as a flow agent. So we really need to understand those ingredients and have them analyzed prior to usage to make sure we understand what the diet will bring us.
For sure. Anything that we didn't touch on with calcium and phosphorus, Dr. Stein?
Well, I mean, for the sows, as I said, we are early on, whereas growing finishing pigs, we think we understand that, but sows, we're very early on, so there's a lot of work to be done to measure the digestibility. But based on what we know today in terms of digestibility, if you do some factorial calculations for a lactating sow, it's not too complicated because we know how much milk she'll produce, and we know that the calcium in milk is usually 0.2%, phosphorus 0.15%. So we can calculate how much calcium and phosphorus that sow will deposit in the milk every day. Then you add a little bit for the maintenance of the sow, and you can kind of come up with a requirement that way. And if you do that, and you take into account the relatively low digestibility we have for both calcium and phosphorus by sows, then you come to some surprisingly high requirement estimates that are greater than we have seen in the past. We have done those calculations and we have published those calculations, but we really, really need to get them validated because they are surprisingly high, those requirement estimates. But at the same time, we also have sows today that produce more milk than earlier sows did. So and they have more pigs. So maybe it is correct that we have a greater greater requirement than we had previously. But that's something I really would like to have confirmed and have validated.
Yeah, I'll keep my eye on that one for sure, as I'm sure many of our listeners will. You have us intrigued there, Hans. So, yes.
Very good.
It's time for our famous three.
Broiler Savvy, the pioneering AI-powered solution for broiler gut functionality and metabolic efficiency insights. Cargill Animal Nutrition and Health Pork Solutions delivers trusted, data-driven nutrition and business support, helping you build more profitable, confident pork systems. KT Pacer, 50 years designing and building feed transportation equipment focused on quality, workmanship, and performance. Every pig, regain control of your wean-to-finish operation. Catch problems early, save pig lives. Aurora Pharmaceutical, veterinary solutions for real-world animal care. BinSentry, the most trusted feed monitoring solution in the world. Discover veterinary solutions designed for the real-world challenges of animal care with Aurora Pharmaceutical. Founded by a swine veterinarian, Aurora develops innovative, practical products that support veterinarians and producers in improving animal health and managing the challenges they face every day. Explore our animal health solutions and learn more about how Aurora Pharmaceutical is advancing veterinary care. Visit us today at aurorapharmaceutical.com. Aurora Pharmaceutical, veterinary solutions for real-world animal care.
Awesome. Well, hey, I always love ending podcasts on some different questions so our audience can get to know you a little bit better. So first question here, Dr. Stein, what's the biggest hurdle that you overcame in your career that you're the proudest of?
I think being a foreigner and being a professor at the university in the United States, that always comes with some extra challenges and some extra hurdles. And I think you always feel you have to prove yourself a little bit more just because you are a foreigner. So maybe that would be up there. And of course, there are many other things, but I think that's probably number one.
What's your favorite part of summer, right? So the undergrad population's a little bit down on campus. Yeah. Your graduate students probably don't have classes, but what do you enjoy about summer the most?
I always wanted to live in the tropics. So here in the summer in Illinois, we feel like we are living in the tropics. I like an environment where we can wear shorts and T-shirts, and I love gardening. Those are favorite things about summer for me. And of course, this year we have a World Cup that just make it better.
Oh yeah, for sure, and stateside. So yeah, that's beyond awesome. Yes, you were talking about the international community, right? In Illinois has got a deep one for sure. But it's been so fun to talk to the international peers of mine that I went to graduate school with and have known so much. You know, just talking about the World Cup every evening has been really fun. So
yes.
Yeah, a lot of trash talk between friends over the past week or so.
I would imagine.
Yes. What's your favorite pork recipe?
Pork ribs.
Oh yes.
Pork ribs. Yeah. I love pork ribs, and I try to eat it in as many different countries as I can. So the first thing I look at if I get into a restaurant in a different country, I always look at to see if they have pork ribs. So. That's my favorite.
No, that's very tough to beat. All right, last question. What do you enjoy most about mentoring graduate students?
Oh, a lot of things. I usually say that the one thing that really keeps me in academia is working with graduate students. That is for sure what I enjoy a lot of things, but many of the things I do, I could also do in other settings. But the working with graduate students is the one thing that keeps me in academia. And I think a lot of times you see students coming in after their bachelor's degree without knowing too much about research and publications and giving presentations at professional meetings and all those things we try to teach graduate students. And so then you look at that student 6 months later, you say, oh, she learned this much or he learned this much. And 6 months later, oh, he took another step and so forth. That is really the gratifying part of being a professor to me. And then, of course, see the students finish and go out in the industry and contribute and feel confident and stand up and say, hey, based on what I know, we can do it this or this way or this way. And see, I mean, reality is if you get a PhD in nutrition, you really, really have to screw up to not become successful. Because there are so many opportunities and there are lots of good jobs and so that is a big joy for me to see I follow all my former students and I've had about 75 graduate students in my career and I follow all of them and I know where they are and what they're doing and it's a great joy for me to see how they are succeeding in their careers and in their lives.
Well, you've done an outstanding job with that. We could spend another 25 minutes highlighting between the two of us how successful your students have been and how honored I am to call them peers within my profession. And I would say not only you, but your counterparts as well have ensured that a PhD in nutrition and specifically swine nutrition has a high standard.
Yeah.
Right. So yes, there are lots of opportunities out there and you can be extremely successful. The other fold of that is we make sure that we're well trained and you do an outstanding job of maintaining that standard for my profession. So I just want to say a big thank you. So, well, with that, Dr. Stein, thank you for your time. This was outstanding. I definitely enjoyed the conversation and I'm sure others will. So with that, we'll conclude this episode of the Swine It Podcast. We come out with episodes every Tuesday and hope you check them out as you can. We'll talk to you later.
Okay. Thank you.
Do you feel overwhelmed with mundane tasks that eat up your valuable time? It's time to reclaim your schedule and focus on what truly matters. Get your time back with Elite Remote Talent with APA Time Zone Hassle. delegate $10 an hour tasks to focus on your $1,000 an hour tasks. Schedule your free strategy call at wisevas.io.